fourth point is reflecting on the faults of the samsara. The first fault is the fault of uncertainty. And while you wander within the samsara, there is no definiteness in terms of who is your friend and who is your enemy. And there is nothing in the samsara which is trustworthy, as is said in the Nagarjuna's letter to the friend, that with the change of your life, your father will be born as your child, your mother will be born as your wife, and so on. And normally when we have some close friends where we can trust, then we feel relaxed and very happy, and we dislike enemy that disturbs us. But is there a real certainty between friends and enemies? If there is a definiteness, then it is worthwhile to develop excessive attachment to your relatives and friends, and to dislike and hate your enemies. But there is no certainty. Not only there is no certainty in terms of your friends and relatives that they change with the change of life, but even in this life there is no certainty, that as the great master Kung Sang Tenbedom has said, that the so-called your very beloved friend today, with the slightest change and use of word, he or she might become your sworn enemy the next moment, the next time. So there is no definiteness, there is no certainty. And in this way you will develop some kind of convincing understanding that there is no certainty about your enemy and friends. And the second fault or shortcoming is the fault of lack of satisfaction or lack of contentment, as is said in the Nagarjuna's letter to the friend. And with respect to our enjoyment of sensual objects, there is no contentment and no satisfaction within the samsara. Just like a leper, because of the leprae, when he or she sits near the fire, may feel some kind of soothing effect, but that will not remove the leprosy. So similar is the case with our enjoyment of the wealth or enjoyment of the sensual objects. With craving to some kind of satisfaction, we develop strong attachment to the sensual objects, which is the source of such satisfaction and contentment. And therefore we run in pursuit of such sensual objects. But the nature of such sensual object is such that they will not give you long-lasting satisfaction and contentment, because the more you enjoy that sensual object, the less will be satisfaction and contentment. In fact, enjoying the sensual object is just like drinking salty water. The more you drink, the more you get thirsty. And because of lack of satisfaction, again you mentally get disturbed and unhappy. And this is what we experience. For example, due to lack of contentment, if you have 1, you want 10. If you get 10, you want 100. If you get 100, you want 1,000. So there is no contentment, there is no satisfaction. And in general, I tell people that with respect to those material objects where there is a limitation, it is important to maintain contentment and satisfaction. And if it is an another object, like the spiritual realm, a spiritual field, when there is no limitless, you should not get contented, you should not get satisfied. Now, in the case of those material facilities that facilitate the well-being of our physical body, there is a limitation. And however much progress you make, it will be limited within this world and not beyond it. If at the maximum you can move on to the moon or some other planets, and you can extend to that scope, to that level, and beyond that, you will not be able to you will not go beyond some of these constellations and so on. So in the case of material objects, there is such a limitation. So since there is limitation in those material objects, it's important that we should develop contentment. So whether it's in case of us, the Tibetans, or in the case of the rest of the world, we have this very ugly tendency that if there is no increase in the national gross product, then people think that something is wrong with the economy. But not realizing that there is limitation in those material objects. So it is important to reach certain limit and then maintain contentment. And with lack of contentment, if you keep on wanting more and more, and then, of course, because of limitation of the object, you will not achieve everything that you want, and then you get unhappy and you get frustrated. And at such point, if you blame everything for yourself, then it's fine. But normally we have, again, this very ugly tendency of pointing the blame to someone else. And this then produces lack of harmony and conflict. And therefore, in the case of those objects, which is the object of desire, if there is a limitation, since there is limitation, it is important to maintain contentment. Now, in the case of those mental qualities, like spiritual practices, they can be developed to limitless quality, and therefore, it is not good to maintain contentment, because if you maintain contentment, then it's your personal problem. Because there is a limitless opportunity to develop, but still if you don't use that opportunity, then you are wasting that opportunity. So this is how should we practice, this should be our attitude. So in the case of material object, if you get the necessary facilities, then you should get contented. Now for example, look at the gap between the rich and the poor, and even these poor people, they have the same right to possess and own as is owned and possessed by the wealthy and the rich people. Now, for example, today if we see the world, the northern world and the southern world, the southern world is quite poor, and the main population of the world are inhabiting in the southern continent, southern area, southern world, and these people have every right to enjoy happiness and peace and material prosperity as is enjoyed by the northerners. And therefore it is clear that this big gap between the southerner and northerner is not a healthy thing. And we must remove therefore the problems of the southerners and uplift their status, economical status. However, in terms of practical practice, If the southerners' standard of living reaches up to the standard of living of the northerners, then simply whether it's electricity, or whether it is the food, it is questionable whether the natural resource will be enough to maintain such a standard. So this is very confusing and very complex. And so therefore the best is to maintain contentment. And of course you need the basic necessities, and then get contented, then everybody will have happiness. And that's why I jokingly tell people that even if you are a very wealthy and rich person, you have only one stomach. And the wealthy or rich people does not mean that they have a double stomach or two stomachs. And particularly in the case of some poor people, even though they have nothing much to eat, sometimes I see some poor people having big stomach. And similarly in the case of the clothing, and particularly in terms of ornaments like earrings or finger rings, many of them I would consider almost like a waste. And even if you are very rich, the maximum rings you can wear is 10 rings on each fingers, and not more than that. And if you put 2-3 rings on each of the fingers, it doesn't really look beautiful. It will be very ugly. And whatever beautiful kind of ear ornament you have, you can put 2, or maybe some people try to put 2-3 ear ornaments one after the other in line, but it doesn't look good. So this I would say illusion within illusion. Well, probably I'm making such a good statement because we the monks are not entitled to use this. Probably if I have the opportunity, maybe I'm wearing some long earrings or something. And lack of contentment, not only you create problems to others, but in your own case, because of lack of contentment, you always remain hungry. You want more and more. And therefore, one of the Kadamba masters earlier said that those people who have contentment, then the rich man is really sleeping or lying there. And in the case of those who have no contentment, even if they are very rich, because they are always hungry for more and more, they are still poor. So in real sense, they are still suffering from poverty, mental poverty. So in the case of external material development, we should be contented. In the case of spiritual development, we should not be contented, but we just do the opposite. In the case of spiritual development, we get very easily contented and we don't want to make effort. In this case of external development, we never get contented. Look at the Tibetans. Because of lack of contentment, they make every attempt to either try to move to America or to England or to some European countries with the hope to get some good, better jobs and more money. And I think it was in Bodh Gaya when I jokingly told people that I told Tibetans that unless you make an effort, you won't become rich. Of course, in Tibetan Buddhist practice, there are many practices propitiating certain deities who are supposed to be making your life successful and rich. And there is practice of Zambala and so on. But we don't have any millennials among the Tibetans. We propitiate these deities. Now, in the case of Westerners, they don't have these different deities to propitiate for wealth and economical prosperity, but there are many millionaires and billionaires. So it's only necessary that, particularly in the case of some of these deities who are supposed to be the deity of the wealth and who have hanging bellies, so probably they are themselves millionaires. Because of their hanging belly, probably they are very rich. But it seems they don't have much power to make us millionaire or billionaire. So in the case of those areas where there is a limitation, you should have contentment. In the case of other areas, like development of loving-kindness, compassion and bodhicitta, we should not get contented. But unfortunately, we very easily get contentment. And because you don't like those things to practice, right from the beginning, you discourage yourself by saying that, I can't do this practice. This is so difficult and problematic. So if this is your courage, if this is your spirit, even at this time when we have this wonderful human life and intelligence, then how can you expect to get a better life in the future? If you go on retracing back from such spiritual practices, then it is not sure where will you be born in the future life. And it is possible that in the future life you will be born in a place where even if you are born as a very handsome young man or very beautiful woman, but you will never get an opportunity to undertake such a practice. You will never get such an opportunity. So today, irrespective of whether you are a young or even very old man and woman, still you are a human being with human intelligence. Therefore, do not get contented with spiritual practice. And without contentment, when you make an effort, then gradually you can really develop these qualities. So it is wrong to get contented in those areas where there is scope for limitless progress and development. And the fact that there is no contentment with the enjoyment of the sensual object is again explained in many texts. For example, in some of these texts, it says that in many of our past lives, we may have enjoyed almost everything, but we never contented. And so whatever prosperity and goodness that we had experienced while we are born in the samsara, we never made any genuine progress, because all these excellences and perfections, seemingly perfect facilities that we enjoyed in the samsara, had always deceived us. And therefore, in the future also, if you do not make an effort, you will continue to suffer in the same way. And the great master Sanghuwa has also said that until now, you experience many ups and downs in this samsaric life. And if you now do not develop some understanding about all those experiences, then there will be no opportunity for making further progress. So you should meditate on this until you are able to develop some kind of appreciation and understanding. And particularly in the case of the renunciates, the monastics, it is your task and responsibility to be contented, and particularly in your case, by adopting the monastic costumes, what you take interest is to accumulate wealth and money, then that is very unfortunate. And particularly in your case, if you meddle in the affairs of your family members, like your parents and so on, and help them in their day-to-day business and so on, then this is again very sad. So you need to show your greatness in terms of your spiritual practice, hearing, thinking, and meditation, which is suitable to the costumes that you wear. And the next fault is the fault of having to give up your body again and again. And having got the body of ascended being, you had to give it repeatedly. And if it was possible to collect all the bones of the body that you have taken in different forms of ascended beings, then if you pile all those bones up, it will be greater than Mount Meru. And the fourth fault is the fault of having to take the conception again and again. And the fifth fault is the fault of becoming high and low, repeatedly becoming high and low. As he said in the letter to the friend by Nagarjuna, that in one life you may be born as Shakra, the king of the god realm, and then again through the force of the karma, you will fall into such a lower state. And at one particular moment, you may be born in a realm of the god, where you are able to fondle and enjoy the breast and hips of a celestial damsel. But again, with the change of life, you may be born into a hell realm, where your whole body is crushed and slashed. So that is the fault of ups and downs. All this point sums up in the quotation from the Vinaya, where it says everything that you accumulate will finally come to an end, will be consumed, and all that is high will fall, and everything that comes into contact will finally separate, and the end of life is death. So whatever perfections that you experience in the samsara, they are not reliable, and finally they will come to an end through disintegration, through change. And not only that, and many of the so-called positive experiences in the samsara are in reality not genuine happiness and peace. We experience such kind of happinesses because of reduction of certain major sufferings. When we reduce certain major sufferings, then we feel some sense of relief. and we then identify that as happiness. So this is absolutely true. And the fourth fault and shortcoming is the shortcoming of having no friends that would accompany you. So it is important to know this, and therefore what is important is to rely on the three lights of accumulating merit, that is the light of the virtuous deeds. And you should always hold the light of virtuous deeds up, and this kind of virtuous light will be useful when in the future life you will travel to darkness where there is no sign of sun and moon. And these six shortcomings can be summarized into the 3 points, that is, nothing in the samsara is reliable, and there will be no satisfaction however much we enjoy the sensual objects within the samsara, and the fact that we have been wandering within this samsara from beginningless time. The first point, that nothing in the samsara is reliable, will be explained under 4 points. That is, the physical body that you have obtained today is not reliable because you have to give this body again and again, give up this body again and again. And then the second is that the harms and benefits that is done to you are also not reliable. And the wealth and the perfections that you achieve in the samsara is also not reliable. And the friends that whom you associate with is also not reliable. And the third point is that you have been wandering within the samsara from beginningless time. That means being born in this samsara, and there is no end to it. And then if you are someone who has greater mental capacity for meditating, then you should meditate as is taught in the letter to the friend by Nagarjuna, where Nagarjuna kings the call by saying that you should reflect on how the beings in the samsara are deprived of the things that they want, and the sufferings of death, sickness, old age. And so by seeing this samsara as the source of many aspects of suffering, we should feel saddened or disgusted by such a samsaric existence. So in short, you should see these 5 psychophysical aggregates as in the nature of suffering. So in the Lamrim Chemo, it explains about 5 sufferings in relation to birth. So if you reflect on these points, and reflect on the fact that all the 5 psychophysical aggregates in the nature of suffering, then that will, or that should make some impact on your life. And similarly, you should reflect on the 8 types of suffering and the 3 types of suffering. And by reflecting on that, you should remember the individual and the specific sufferings of the 6 types of beings in the samsara. When we talk about 3 types of sufferings, they are suffering of suffering, suffering of change, and conditioned suffering. The sufferings of, for example, being born in a bad state of existence is suffering of suffering. And and then we have the suffering of change, and then finally the conditioned suffering. I have explained these 3 sufferings, and out of these 3 types of sufferings, for a serious Buddhist practitioner, the main suffering on which you should contemplate is the conditioned suffering. And the conditioned sufferings can be understood by reflecting on the 12 links of dependent origination. And out of the 12 links of the dependent origination, the first member is ignorance. Ignorance is an afflictive emotion which disturbs our mind, which destroys our well-being. out of many types of afflictive emotions. The main source is ignorance. Ignorance here means that even though by nature we all want happiness and do not want suffering, but because ignorance and because of lack of knowledge and because of misconception of reality, that we suffer. And in fact, the word ignorance itself is something inauspicious, something that is not good, something that we do not like. Let me drink, let me complete my tea. The tea is delicious. And do you see this cup quite big? Probably it will be very useful to use it as a weapon to hit it on a head. His Holiness is referring, making this point because normally in the monasteries, sometimes when they have a disagreement or fight, sometimes the only weapon they have is the cup they are using, so they use it. So sometimes you see some marks and signs on the head of another monk, which they call it the sign of the mark. So His Holiness is saying probably this is a good mark to make a sign. Finally, I have finished it. Come and take away the cup. So the more you are able to see the destructive influence of afflictive emotions, the more you will develop hatred towards afflictive emotion, the more you will dislike it, and thereby you will be able to make an effort to distance yourself from such afflictive emotions, realizing that so long as I am controlled by afflictive emotions, it will not be possible for me to experience happiness. And allowing the afflictive emotions to arise is a total self-deception and total self-destruction. You will be able to realize that. And in the Paramana Vatika, in the Buddhist text of epistemology, it discusses about the nature of these afflictive emotions and whether these afflictive emotions can be removed or not and whether it is possible to achieve liberation or not. So therefore, in order to develop a fuller understanding of the nature of conditioned suffering, it is important to understand the nature of afflictive emotions, and it is through this way that you will be able to develop a strong sense of appreciation towards liberation or nirvana. So with regard to the contemplation on all these individual sufferings of the six types of beings in the three realms, here in the text it says, if you reflect on the sufferings through many ways, then you will be able to see the faults of samsara in many ways. And if you reflect on this with a strong motivation, then your understanding will be stronger. And if you meditate on them for a long time, then your understanding and your being able to see the faults of samsara will also be continuous and sustained. And it is in this respect that study is so important, because if you study and understand many reasons why we suffer, or what are the natures of sufferings, or what are the natures of afflictive emotions, so having reflected through many ways on these different types of suffering, and when you are able to develop strong conviction, and then this strong conviction will really make a movement within your mind. For example, if you reflect on the benefits of compassion, and if you develop the understanding that compassion is nothing to do with a particular religion, but that it is beneficial and useful to everybody, and therefore that this is absolutely necessary, then naturally you will develop some kind of appreciation towards it. But at the same time, you may not have very strong feeling within your mind. But if you make your mind habituated with such understanding continuously, then gradually you will be able to develop it on the level of your feeling. And if you reflect on this point for a long time, then for a long time you will be able to see the faults of the samsara. So here you can see that there are many levels of removing the faults. First of all, you have a wrong consciousness, a mistaken mind, which one pointedly grasps or perceives an object in the wrong way. And then gradually, when you see the reason how this wrong conception is misperceiving a particular object, then that will help reduce the intensity of that misconception, and gradually you will develop some doubt. Now, for example, imagine that you are at a level where you say that I am sure that there is no past life and future lives. And then if somebody asks you why you don't believe past and future lives, then the only answer you will say is, I don't believe in it because I have not seen one. Then you will be asked another question by saying, does this mean that whatever you have not seen are non-existent? And once I was discussing with one Chinese leader, and we were just joking, and then I asked one question whether he doesn't believe in such a thing. He doesn't believe in such thing. Then I said, do you mean that whatever you have not seen, when I asked him, is it necessary that you should see everything that is existent? And then he said, no. But I couldn't argue further because he was the more powerful person. So therefore, not having seen something is not a reason to prove that things are not existent. So therefore you say there is no past and future life by simply saying I don't believe in it because I haven't seen it. So the main reason will be that I simply don't believe in it. But at the same time, if you say that whatever you have not seen is non-existent, then this will invite more problems. So there will be a moment when you wholeheartedly say there is no past and future lives, but then continuous questions are asked, then gradually you will develop some doubt, because earlier you made a strong decision saying that there is no past and future life. You were quite decisive on that, but then with repeated questions you develop some kind of doubt. So it is almost like melting an ice. It will gradually start melting down, and then from doubt you will gradually move to some correct assumption, and then you will be able to develop some inferential cognition, and then gradually you will be able to develop direct perception. So it is through this direct perception that you are able to directly relate it to your own experience. So in the case of all conditioned phenomena, they change not at one moment or one, but they change gradually within a given period of time. So similar in the case of transformation of our mind also, with effort it can gradually change. Now, with regard to different types of experiences also, there are some kind of experience which arises when you reflect on a particular reason, and when you don't reason them out, the experiences doesn't arise. So these are called contrived experience, where you need to make an effort. Then gradually you are able to develop what is known as uncontrived experience, where the experience will arise automatically. So by seeing the faults of samsara in this way, and when you develop a wish to get out of it, and then you will be able to conclude that out of the many paths that leads to liberation from samsara, that leads to achievement of nirvana, the most important path is the bodhicitta. Those virtuous practices which are aimed towards achieving better rebirth, like the life of a human being or a god, and similarly other virtuous practices which are targeted towards achieving liberation, these practices not necessarily will lead to achieving enlightenment. And on the other hand, if you develop bodhicitta, or if you undertake any practice which is influenced by the development of bodhicitta, then you will definitely be led to enlightenment. And therefore, here it says that out of many virtuous practices and paths, the most important is the development of bodhicitta. And therefore, all these practices should be seen as contributing factors for developing bodhicitta. So this completes the preliminary teaching, the introductory practices. The introductory practices for development of compassion and bodhicitta. Because in order to develop compassion, earlier I mentioned that it is important to understand suffering upon yourself and suffering of other sentient beings. And so these preliminary practices explaining natures of suffering and so forth have been explained. And particularly today, you have this opportunity to undertake such a practice and to remove afflictive emotions and sufferings. It is important to make this effort, and by reflecting upon the sufferings that by which you are afflicted, you are also able to see the sufferings by which the sentient beings are afflicted. And once you are able to develop a good understanding of the suffering nature of all sentient beings, then whenever you relate to different people, you will not develop competitiveness or hatred, because you are also be able to see all of them as enslaved by attachment, enslaved by hatred, enslaved by ignorance, and so on. Of course, you can't 100% make a judgment of other people, because some may be manifestation of some great beings and so on. But generally speaking, people are all enslaved by afflictive emotions. And particularly in the case of poor people who do not have much wealth, much knowledge, much power, it seems they have less arrogance, less pride. And gradually when you earn more wealth and get more education and become more powerful and famous, then you become arrogant and proud, and then you tend to exploit others and deceive others and look down upon others. Now, on the other hand, of course, in the text it says some of these good qualities that you have are kind of facilitating factors as a result of your past life's good karmic practice. But however, if you do not use these positive facilities that you have today in the right way, they could become destructive. And next is the process of training the mind in the bodhicitta, which is the actual practice. And this will be explained under many subtitles. The first is relating to the stages of practicing the conventional bodhicitta. And this point again will be explained by saying that the bodhicitta is the only entrance to Mahayana. According to some Kadampa masters, they would explain the... According to the ancient Kadampa masters, they would explain the development of ultimate bodhicitta first and then the conventional bodhicitta later. And according to the letter or new Kadamba practice, starting from Tsongkhapa, the explanation of the ultimate bodhicitta is explained later on. And this is also very relevant, because unless you have a strong backing of the practice and development of conventional bodhicitta, then your view of emptiness might become partial, become a partial practice, and there is then danger and risk of falling into lower paths like the path of the Sarvakas and Pratika Buddhas. However, in general, the view of emptiness is not unique. I would say that the view of emptiness in general is not necessarily a unique view of the Mahayanas. And of course, if you use the wording like ultimate bodhicitta, then you are talking about view of emptiness that is influenced by bodhicitta. Then of course, this is different. This is then related to the Mahayana practice. But otherwise, if you simply talk about the view of emptiness, I would say it is a common practice. And in order to develop genuine appreciation of liberation and a genuine sense of taking refuge to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the view of emptiness is important. And therefore, this view of emptiness is related to all subjects of practice that is explained in the Lamrim. And as I earlier cited the quotation from Lama Selimba, where he says the view of self is a kind of a source of enlightenment, and in that case probably view of emptiness is not necessary, but otherwise the view of emptiness is extremely important, and particularly in the case of those that possess the lineage of the Mahayana and who are of a sharp mind, then they first of all develop view of emptiness and then develop bodhicitta. And in the case of those who have a blunt mind and who are not so intelligent, they would develop first bodhicitta and then develop a view of emptiness. For example, there is a practitioner who may be a follower of Mahayana school of thought or some other lower Buddhist schools of thought. They do not have the subtle view of emptiness as is explained in the Prasangika Madhyamika system. Now, with regard to the stage of training the mind on the conventional bodhicitta, the text first explains that bodhicitta is the only entrance to Mahayana. Now, if it is necessary to enter into the Mahayana path, what is the door, what is the entrance? Our ultimate objective is to achieve enlightenment, which is also called the state of non-abiding nirvana, the state of Buddhahood or enlightenment. From the perspective of Mahayana is called non-abiding nirvana, because such a state of does not abide or fall into any of the two extremes. That is the extreme of some being in the samsara and the extreme of being satisfied with liberation just for oneself. Now, achievement of such a state of non-abiding nirvana or omniscience is possible by developing bodhicitta or an altruistic wish that focuses on all sentient beings and that aspires to remove the sufferings of all sentient beings. And it is because of such force of the mind that the path that one follows will be very strong, and it will also possess many aspects, and the scope and the extent of the path will be much stronger. On the other hand, right from the beginning, if you develop a motivation of achieving liberation just for yourself alone, and then in that case the extent and the scope of the path will be limited, it will be narrow. And it is because of this, one path is called the lesser vehicle and another is called the greater vehicle. So now when we talk about the Mahayana and Hinayana, or the lesser vehicle and the greater vehicle, sometimes again because of lack of understanding by the people, they think that these two terms are kind of derogatory terms or discriminating terms, and the people then develop some misunderstanding. And because of such misunderstanding, some of the Hinayanas pinpoint faults in the Mahayana teaching, saying that Mahayana teachings are not teaching of the Buddha. And then Mahayanas blame the Hinayanas, saying that it is a lesser vehicle. But if you follow the original teaching and the meaning of the word Hinayana and Mahayana, there is no such meaning of discrimination. Now, in the case of the Mahayana practitioners, if you look at some of the teachings contained in Hinayana, all these Hinayana teachings have their source in the masters from the Nalanda University, the Nalanda scholars. And similar is the case with the Mahayana teachings. They have all their source in the Nalanda scholars. So it is all these texts composed by the masters from this Nalanda scholars which were got translated into Tibetan, and we meditate on these texts and we try to achieve enlightenment based on the contemplation of these texts. And that's why I emphasize and tell people that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is none other than the Nalanda tradition. And very recently I met one Chinese, and he told me that some of them say that the Tibetan Buddhism is a Hinayana Buddhist tradition. So that really surprised me, because I didn't see any reason. And there is some reason to say that Mahayana teachings, for example, when some of the Hinayanis say that Mahayana teachings are corrupted teaching or degenerated teaching, there is some reason to say that. But I do not see the reason of categorizing the Tibetan Buddhist tradition as Hinayana tradition. And it is clear today that the tradition, the Tibetan tradition, is the faultless tradition coming from the Nalanda scholars. So if you ask what is the entrance to the Mahayana path, there are two. The Buddha has taught two levels of teaching, the wisdom perfection teachings and the tantric teachings. And there is no other path or teaching that he has given. And whichever of these two vehicles or paths that you enter, the door is bodhicitta. And as and when you develop such a bodhicitta, then you have entered the path which has committed, which will lead you to the greater path or the greater vehicle. Now, on the other hand, if you develop a motivation of achieving enlightenment, not only achieving liberation, but achieving enlightenment for yourself, then that will not become a Mahayana practice. Now, on the other hand, if you develop a motivation thinking that I will achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, and if I'm able to achieve enlightenment, then that fulfills my dream, my life, and meaning of my life, and so on, then you become a Mahayana practitioner. So, with the existence of the bodhicitta, everything that you will do become a Mahayana practice. And in the absence of bodhicitta, even if you undertake a deity yoga practice and visualization, it will become a Hinayana practice and not a Mahayana practice. And as and when you develop bodhicitta, even if you have not developed any other quality, you will be called as a Mahayana. And as and when you are deprived of such a bodhicitta, even if you have other realizations, like realization of emptiness, and whatever other qualities you may have, then you will fall into lower grounds, like the Sarvaka grounds and so on, and you degenerate from the category of Mahayana. And this has been taught repeatedly in many Mahayana texts, and this can be proved logically. So therefore, right from the beginning, your being able to enlist yourself among the Mahayana practitioners is dependent on development of this bodhicitta, and later on to be out of the Mahayana is also dependent on the absence of this mind. So whether you are a Mahayana or not is dependent on the existence or non-existence of this mind. And this point has been explained in the Bodhicharya Avatara, and similarly in the biography of Maitreya. And in the biography of Maitreya, he says that in the case of a diamond, even if it is broken, the broken pieces of the diamond will again become an excellent ornament that excels all other jewels and ornaments, and it will also not lose its name as being a diamond, and it will also have the power of removing all poverties. So similarly, as and when you develop bodhicitta, even if you are deprived of any other qualities, you will become a bodhisattva, and you will be able to remove all the poverties of the samsara. And even if you do not engage in such a bodhisattva way of life, simply having that mind, you will become a bodhisattva. And therefore, Nagarjuna in his precious garland says that if for oneself and other worldly beings, if you want to achieve the unsurpassing supreme enlightenment, the root is the development of bodhicitta. And therefore, you should develop bodhicitta, which is stable like Mount Meru. And the same thing is said in the Vajrapani empowerment. When in that text, when a question was asked by saying that how could one explain and show such profound tantric mantras and mandalas and initiations, then this is answered by Vajrapani, saying that such tantric teachings and empowerments should be given only to those people who meditate on bodhicitta. And similarly, in the Gandhava Yuva Sutra, the Buddha says that bodhicitta is like the seed of all the qualities of the Buddha, and it is like a field where all virtuous crops will prosper and develop, and it is like an earth on which the whole holy beings are dependent, and it is like the child of the Sharana deity that removes all the poverties of sentient beings, and it's like a father that protects all the bodhisattvas, and it is like a wish-fulfilling jewel which fulfills all the meanings, and it's like a precious pot, precious vase, which fulfills all the wishes, and it's a spear that defeats the enemy of afflictive emotions, and it's like a weapon which destroys and stops the improper mental engagement, and it's like a sword that beheads the head of the afflictive emotions, and it's like an axe that cuts all the afflictive emotions, and it's like a weapon by which you will be protected from all harms. So as he said in this text, that this is the uncommon entrance to the Mahayana path, and as and when you develop such bodhicitta, and all the negative deeds that you have committed in the past will be burnt and destroyed, and you will be protected from all sufferings and fears, and it is by developing bodhicitta that all positive results like definite goodness and higher status will be achieved. And Tsongkhapa makes a very powerful statement from Lamrim Chemo, which I have noted down here, where it says that merely by seeing and thinking about bodhicitta, it will become a reviving force or energy among the minds of all sentient beings. And it's a great skill, and you should think that how fortunate I am to be able to develop such a mind, and therefore make your every effort to develop such a mind. And earlier we read that when the Buddha thought for countless eons what is it that is most beneficial to the suffering sentient beings, they all found it is this altruism and bodhicitta. So from the time of the Buddha until to the root teacher, they have all meditated on this, and they were able to benefit the suffering sentient beings, benefit the teaching of the Buddha, and benefit themselves. And today throughout the world, when people talk about Buddha, he is seen as an embodiment of non-violence, embodiment of compassion. And whenever they talk about Lord Buddha, they see as the teacher of non-violence, the teacher of compassion. And this is because he has practiced altruism that cherishes the well-being of other sentient beings. And even in the case of the Tibetans, of course among the Tibetans we have very hot-tempered and aggressive people, and we have a lot of shortcomings and faults. And of course we are like any other human being with attachment, hatred and so on. But generally speaking, Tibetans are supposed to be slightly compassionate and slightly good-hearted, and people contribute this to as the Avalokiteshvara's blessing. They say that it's the blessing of the Avalokiteshvara, but primarily it is because of the flourishment of this teaching on the practice of bodhicitta, a teaching that came from India, and whether it is during the time of the first advancement of Buddha Dharma in Tibet or during the later advancement of the Buddha Dharma in Tibet, this teaching on bodhicitta was propagated in Tibet, and it is because of this, irrespective of the depth of our knowledge, we all talk about all mother sentient beings. And in fact, when I meet some of the elderly lady, Tibetan ladies from Lhasa, they would they come to see me and then invite me by saying that, please, His Holiness, come to Tibet for the sake of all mother sentient beings, as if all mother sentient beings lives in Tibet. And then today, even in English word, the mother sentient beings is repeatedly used. And here we are talking about bodhicitta and altruism. So, and therefore, Shantideva has summarized the greatness of bodhicitta by saying that he made a conclusive statement by saying that unless you undertake this practice of exchanging one's suffering with one's happiness with the sufferings of other sentient beings, then you will not achieve enlightenment or nirvana. You will not also have happiness in the samsara. And here he is only saying that even in the case of the relation between a teacher and a student, if there is no genuine sense of helping each other and altruism, then the student will get a lot of beatings from the teacher and he might carry a lot of bumps on the head. And therefore, Tsongkhapa was saying, amazing, I found such a wonderful gift, the gift of bodhicitta, and therefore I should enter into the Mahayana path. So entering into the Mahayana path is not just reading the text, but developing such a mind within oneself. And so bodhicitta is really like a butter that you are able to get by churning the milk of the host of scriptures, and this is a very uncommon cause for achieving enlightenment. So whether you are young or old, rich or poor, we must all develop strong appreciation to develop such a positive, wonderful mind, whether it is the Lama who is heading the congregation. In my own case, I make persistent effort towards development of such altruism, and in your case, and particularly if you are someone who have some kind of faith and devotion to me, then I urge you not to develop faith and devotion to me. There is no need to call me as the manifestation of Avalokiteshvara or Buddha. What is important is that you do your own practice of developing bodhicitta, and that will please all the root and lineage lamas, and that will please the Buddhas, and that will help suffering sentient beings. Next second point is the actual explanation of training the mind, which has two subdivisions. The first subdivision is the actual instruction of training in the conventional bodhicitta, and this will further be explained under two divisions. The first division explains about the stages of training the mind that aspires the purposes of other sentient beings, and by seeing the qualities and the faults, first of all you should undertake the practice of exchanging oneself for others. Now, with regard to the practice of development of bodhicitta, the great Buddhist pioneers, they taught two ways of developing such a bodhicitta, that is aspiring the purposes of other sentient beings and aspiring enlightenment or Buddhahood. And in the case of the first practice, that is fulfilling or aspiring the purposes of other sentient beings, first of all, it is important, in both the cases, it is important to see the sentient beings who are the object of your benefit, doing the benefit. It is important to see all these sentient beings as something close and very dear to your heart. And how this will be established? If you follow the practice of the seven cause effect relationship, and then by seeing that you are developing attachment to your relatives and friends, and hatred and disliking towards your enemies, and neutral attitude towards the neutral sentient beings, so first of all you should develop a feeling of closeness towards everybody with an equal attitude. Just as when we plant a tree and so on, first of all we have to level the ground. So similarly, first we should level our mind without developing attachment to some and hatred to others, or feeling of neutrality to the others. With regard to all sentient beings, see them as your mothers, and how they have been kind to you when they have been acting as your mothers. And then remembering their kindness, and then developing a wish to repay their kindness. And when you are able to see the kindness of these sentient beings, then you will be able to see them as something very close and dear to your heart, that they are very precious to me and very kind to me. And it's after that that you develop compassion, wishing that they be free from suffering, and also loving kindness, wishing that they meet with happiness, and that will be followed by developing special sense of responsibility, and then finally bodhicitta. Now this point makes it clear that we undertake the meditation on equanimity in order to remove attachment, hatred, and feeling of neutrality. And now this is important, because otherwise you might feel that why is there need to develop equanimity in the beginning? We can right now extend the kind of feeling of love and compassion that we have towards our relatives and friends. We can simply extend that to the enemies and to the neutral sentient beings. You might get that kind of feeling, but this is not correct, because the kind of loving kindness and compassion that you have towards your sentient, to your relatives and friends, is still alloyed with attachment. And the kind of love and compassion that we have towards our relatives and friends is very much dependent on how they behave to us. Now, for example, when we identify some as friends, some as enemies, some as neutral, and so on, we cannot categorize them as friends, enemies, and neutral sentient beings by themselves. From the you categorize some as your friends because of the fact that they like you or they have been helping you, and you categorize some as enemies because they disturb you or they dislike you. So you are almost saying that I am doing good things to him because he is doing good things to me. Now when we talk about developing bodhicitta, we are not making such a distinction. We are simply thinking about the nature of the sentient being. We are not seeing sentient being whether they are beneficial to you or whether they have been harmful to you. But you are simply judging the nature of these sentient beings and saying that I like to help them because they are like me, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And based on that, so in from that perspective, all sentient beings are same. And from that level, enemies are also same. The enemies are definitely harming you and disturbing you, but in terms of their nature, they are also like me, wanting happiness and not suffering. And therefore, developing attachment, hatred, and so on is based on their relation towards you, and therefore the kind of love and affection that you have to your friends and relatives is also not very sound. And therefore, first of all, you should level your mind, get rid of all these biased attitudes, and then see them as all as your mother sentient beings. And of course, generally speaking, in order for the child to come, the child is dependent on father and mother. But in the case of the mother before the conception, before the child takes birth, the mother carries the child in the womb for more than 9 months. And in this way, the child is much more physically connected to the mother, and this does not at all have the implication that father is something bad, or also not saying that your father should be ignored. And obviously, there will be those fathers who probably may be more compassionate than a particular mother. But generally speaking, because of this much more kind of care taken by the mother, and because of much more physical contact, we talk about all sentient beings as mother sentient beings. And particularly in the case of some birds and some other animals, the father simply produces the child and then disappears. And it's the mother who looks after the child. And even if you look at the female dog, and some of these dogs, they really are very physically very weak and fragile, and still the puppies run after them, and they look after them. And in the case of the male dogs, they simply produce the child, make the child, and then they lead almost like an independent life and doesn't care much about their children. So therefore, even in the case of animals, the mothers are especially kind. So based on the human experience, we regard mother as the most important friend or relative, and therefore we talk about all sentient beings as mother sentient beings, and then remember their kindness and develop a vision of their kindness. And in the case of training the bodhicitta mind in accordance with the Shanti Deva, then you reflect on the faults of self-cherishing attitude through many ways, and then you reflect on the many advantages of cherishing the well-being of other sentient beings, and then you develop a very close feeling towards all sentient beings who are the objects of your benefit. And through that way, when you see the countless faults of self-cherishing attitude and you see the benefits of the mind cherishing the well-being of other sentient beings, and then through that way, because of habituation with such a practice, you will be able to remember all sentient beings as very kind to yourself, and you will be able to blame everything for oneself. In this way, it is possible to develop a feeling of closeness and closeness to others, and you will be able to see others as very dear to yourself, and therefore you should reflect through many ways how they are, how other sentient beings are kind to you. And in accordance with the Bodhisattva Chekhova, his process of training the mind on bodhicitta is in accordance with the Shanti Deva tradition. So this will be explained under 2 points. And first of all, by reflecting on the faults of self-cherishing attitude, treat this self-cherishing attitude as something that must be eliminated. And by reflecting on the many advantages of cherishing the well-being of other sentient beings, see that as something that must be adopted. And the root line from the 7 points on mind training says that all fault lies with one, that means with oneself. And in the case of us sentient beings, we encounter many sufferings that we do not like, and we are unable to achieve much success in those things that we want, and the blame goes to one, and you should not blame to some external objects or to some others, because you are then blaming to the wrong target. And it is because of this self-cherishing attitude we are born within one of the 5 or 6 migrations. And in our case, with regard to the self-cherishing attitude and the self-grasping attitude, even though these two are the most destructive enemies, but because of our way of life, we have always allowed and permitted these two negative emotions reside peacefully within our mind. We may be totally oblivious of the person sitting next to you on your right or on your left, but you are allowing these two negative emotions reside peacefully within your heart, within your mind. And generally speaking, a kind of egoism is, I would say, found there in the mind of even our bodhicitta. But in our case, these two negative emotions, this self-cherishing attitude and self-grasping, reside peacefully within our heart, supporting each other and developing all the afflictive emotions. And all the problems and sufferings that arise within our mind do not come from without causes or inconcordant causes. And it comes from actions and afflictive emotions, and out of which the man is the afflictive emotion, and out of afflictive emotions it is this ignorance of self-grasping which is the root cause of production of all sufferings, as is stated in the Bodhicharya Avatara. And particularly these afflictive emotions which are led by self-grasping is very destructive, and there is no way you can associate with them for a long time without being disturbed, without being destroyed. The Lord, the leader and the source of all this afflictive emotion is self-grasping, the ignorance. And if you associate with this self-grasping for a long time, you will only suffer, as is said in the Bodhicharya Avatara, that since such a destructive ignorance abides within your heart, there is no way you can remain without fear, and there is no way you can remain joyful. And particularly the self-cherishing attitude has brought many harms and destructions, and it had stopped you from receiving many benefits, and therefore you should be resentful and you should be disgusted with such a self-cherishing attitude. And it is because of ignorance that you see yourself as something very important, and you develop self-cherishing attitude. And it is because of this ignorance that you cherish yourself and you discard others, and thus you wield such a wrong view, you wield the weapon of wrong view, and you intentionally ignore virtuous deeds and non-virtuous deeds, and thus you cut the life of a higher rebirth and nirvana. And so therefore this is the real butcher, and this is true, because whether it is killing or raping or on a minor scale the disagreement between two people, and on a larger scale the conflict between two nations, these two are definitely the result of ignorance and self-cherishing attitude. So therefore this is really like a butcher that destroys the life of nirvana. And it is this self-cherishing attitude that it wields the three poisonous afflicting emotions and destroys the crop of precious deeds, and therefore this is the real robber. And and this is also the real source of destruction, because you allow this self-cherishing attitude to reside peacefully within your heart, and then you accumulate many non-meritorious actions, and it is through performing such non-meritorious actions that you invite all the human harms of human beings and non-human beings. In the field of action, the seed of consciousness is planted, and then it's watered repeatedly by craving and grasping, which projects your life into one of the five or six states of existence. And therefore, this is a kind of karma that plants such a shoot of suffering. And in the past, many Buddhas have visited this world, and in one's own case, one has been born within the samsara repeatedly, but still none of the worldly and transcendental qualities have stuck within your mind, or you are unable to develop any of these mundane and transcendental qualities, and you travel empty-handed, and therefore it is this really self-indulging, self-cherishing attitude. And from the top of the peak of cycle of existence under to the helmet of respite, wherever you are born is a place of suffering, and with whomever you associate, it is a friend of suffering, and whatever you enjoy, it is the enjoyment of suffering. And this is what has been taught in the scriptures of the Buddha and in the commentaries. And this is what you have heard from the mouth of the great teachers. But still, just like an old rock that never gives a piece of food, still you expect something from the perfections of the samsara. And when there is some likelihood of getting some profit and benefit, then you rush there and you will be the first person to arrive there. And when there is a danger or risk, you run away from them. And in the pursuit of those, you never hesitate to deceive, you never hesitate to go to war or deceive your lamas or teachers. And right from your spiritual teacher until to small insects, to the highest you develop jealousy, to those equal you develop competitiveness, and to the lower ones you develop arrogance, and when you are pressed you get arrogant, when you hear something unpleasant you get angry. So this self-cherishing attitude is really like an unbridled animal, and like an unbridled wild horse. And also in the teaching of the Buddha and in the commentaries, it has been repeatedly taught that from virtuous and non-virtuous deeds, happiness and sufferings arise without mistake. And you've heard this repeatedly from your teacher. And you want happiness, you do not want slightest of suffering. But still, even when instigated by others, you are unable to direct your mind towards virtuous deeds. And when it comes to committing natural negative deeds and prohibited negative deeds, you enter into that easily and effortlessly, like the falling of a stream from the steep slope of the mountain. And it is these 84,000 types of conflict emotions that from beginningless time to the time today brought only harm and suffering, and stopped many peace and happiness, the source of peace and happiness. But still you are unable to see those faults. So you are someone who really who possesses eye but unable to see. In short, whether it's the conflict or sufferings, the source of all this is the self-cherishing attitude. And you have allowed yourself physically, verbally, and mentally controlled by such a self-cherishing attitude, which is source of conflict and suffering. And it is this self-cherishing attitude which is really the source of your external enemies, internal disturbance, and the source of all harms. And therefore you should see this self-cherishing attitude as the real enemy. And this is the time that you make a clear distinction between who is your enemy and who is your friend. And as is said by Shantideva, that the time when you brought destruction was a time that is gone, and I have now seen you, so where will you run today? And I will destroy your arrogance, and I will sell you to others. And therefore, you should offer your power to me. However, out of carelessness, if you are not going to submit yourself to me, I will offer it to the guardians of the beings in the hell. And then you will have to suffer there for a long time. And therefore, this is the time that you should now remember how you have brought suffering to yourself. Now I am resentful to you, and I will not allow you to fulfill your self purposes. Meaning that I will now destroy just this self-cherishing attitude, neglecting the well-beings of others. And also additionally, from beginningless time, because of our strong habituation with self-cherishing attitude, that in a particular, when you may be living in a particular place, and even if the rats move and make noise around, the first feeling that you will get is probably that this rat will chop my ears off. And if you hear a thunder and lightning, and suddenly the first feeling that you will get is probably the lightning will first of all fall on my head. And if you visit a risky place, first of all you will develop the feeling or the fear that it will be you who will be first of all carried by the evil spirit. And in this way some people suffer because of fear of bad reputation, and some suffer because not being able to control their enemy, some suffer not being able to look after their friends and relatives. So in this way everybody suffers. So we must identify the source of such suffering. It is the self-cherishing attitude. And that is why great masters like Geshe Namowa, even when he was chopping the tea bricks, he would imagine that he is breaking the self-cherishing attitude. And he would verbally say that, if you remain attentive, I will also remain attentive, and if you relax, I will also relax. And the great master Langri Thangpa used to say that I will offer all my benefit and victory to others, because all well-being comes from others. And I will suffer all the loss and defeat upon myself, because all the harms and sufferings arise from self-cherishing attitude. So if you train your mind in this way, then you will be able to undertake a proper practice. And if you are unable to do such a practice, then even if you wear, say, monk's costume, monk's robes, to a number that would become the lord of a yak, or even if you this initiation 1,000 times, placing the vase on your head, and if you spend your whole life for hearing the Dharma, and whatever kind of practices that you do, you will not be able to get established in the genuine spiritual practices. And if you are able to make such an effort, and then you become a Mahayana whose view is expansive, and who will be able to tolerate things, and who will be able to develop great intelligence. So such a person is then called a Mahayanist, a man with far-sightedness, great intelligence, and so on. In short, you should, with regard to the faults and shortcomings of afflicted emotions, which is rooted in the self-cherishing attitude, even if all the Buddhas of the three times keeps on saying for countless eons, it will not come to an end. But at least you should reflect on some of the points that we have discussed, and that's found in Buddha's teaching and the scriptures. And if you have such an understanding, then your mind will mingle with the Dharma practice, and it will hit the target. And in the absence of such a practice, then all your practices will only become a reviving factor for the self-cherishing attitude, and a factor for further development of ethnic emotions.